Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Adie Packham, and we've all been practicing overhead kicks in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, it's been the tale of two draws on Planet Albion this week, with the boos turning into yahoos in a matter of days. Yes, that's right. A small minority let their frustration show at only being seventh in the table after our 0-0 draw with Leeds on Saturday. Then on Wednesday night, West Ham's inability to beat us in the Premier League was extended by one more game as Neil Maupay went from villain to hero after his last gasp spectacular goal gave us a share of the spoils at the London Stadium. Today, we're on the road again as we take the not-so-short trip across along the coast to Southampton, where former Saint Adam Lallana will not be fit to face his former side after limping out of the game on Wednesday, along with Adam Webster, who is also cropped. Joining me today, we're delighted to welcome back Alan Wares, and also with us is Tom Hylands. Tom, welcome back to the show. Lovely to see you again. You don't look at all jet-lagged.
No, incredibly so, considering just got back from America. But yeah, great to be back with you guys.
What kept you over in America then?
What took me over there?
Yeah.
Family. My brother's been out there for about 15 or 16 years, so haven't been able to see him or his family for 2 years because of the obvious. So good opportunity to get out there.
So we'll talk about the details of the game or the games that you get to see over there, but the games that have taken place this week. But obviously, there's now a growing number. There's a growing sort of alumni of Albion supporters over in America. So I don't know if you managed to get a flavour of anything of a movement or anything going on over there. But also, while we're at it, obviously you watch the Leeds game over there. Tell us about their coverage of a team that, well, frankly, a team like Brighton.
Yeah, to be honest, the coverage out in America is better than what we get in the UK. Every single game is available. They really analyse it. Yes, it has a slightly American skew on it, and you've kind of got more explanation of the rules and whatnot, which actually, to be fair, a lot of people in this country could do with.
Yes.
Not some of the referees come to mind as well, but
we're coming to that.
Yeah,
but you can see every game you want to. Every game has its own place, and it's really seems to be growing.
Yeah. I mean, you've got all sorts of broadcasters over there as well. Do you got Fox? You got Peacock? I've got talking to a few of the guys doing the commentary for him. It's usually the same old suspect. You know, Lee Dixon pops up and everyone else. It's quite the thing. But like you said, I mean, but over there they don't have the 3 o'clock blackout. So that's which is why every game is shown. And I've seen a few of the games on the American feeds, and it's great. I mean, is it Marcus Gale does a lot of stuff with it?
You've got Marcus Gale. I think you've got Robbie Earl, certainly.
Robbie Earl, that's the guy I'm thinking of. Because he's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant.
Basically, what we're talking about here is there's this this group of mediocre, middling players from the sort of lower end of the Premier League from the mid-90s have somehow managed to learn their own lexicon and offload any gibberish they feel like, to be frank, to an American audience. They could actually come up with any old nonsense. And I think that, you know, they'll sup it up like mother's milk. But, you know, there are certain aspects of it. And I think when we had AD, I don't know if you remember this, when we had Ralph Brown, who lives in New York, brilliant actor on, obviously, major Brighton fan. And he was talking about the coverage over there himself, what he gets to see in New York. And, it was along the lines, I think we just played Chelsea and the entire conversation was about Chelsea. Even the goal that Brighton scored against Chelsea was talked about in Chelsea's terms. Now, Tom, obviously we're playing against Leeds who, no longer have the status of the likes of Chelsea anymore and haven't had for 30-odd years. But how did they cover it? I mean, was there a bias one way or the other? Or how do they deal with sort of two teams that are part of the other 14?
Sure. I think if memory serves me right, the commentary was very much in favour of us, if anything. You know, it was all about how good we are, how bad we are in front of goal, and how we're not taking opportunities. You know, the same old commentary that we hear week in, week out at the moment.
Like on the Albion Raw for the past 18 months.
Yeah, but it's I think it does come down to the fact that, you know, it's two teams that aren't in that Super League 6 or whatever. Yeah. So the coverage is a bit more balanced in that sense.
Okay. Well, let's just move on. We're going to talk about the Leeds game in a minute. But, I mean, there's been one story that's been dominating the mainstream media about the Albion this week. And Sussex Bay stuff, it's not Ralph Rangnick's time at Southwick.
I can tell you about that, though, if you wish.
Yeah, I'm sure you could. You could. But
I've been asked to design a T-shirt for that, believe it or not.
Yeah, I know. And you got some spelling wrong, I understand.
Yeah, well, to be fair, it was a Polish town. But I reckon if we did this T-shirt, we can sell loads of Man United fans, and I might actually get rich one day, and I'll buy you a pint willingly this time.
But I mean, the story was at the end of the game at the Amex last Saturday, where some boos were ringing around the Amex, which was not. It was the coldest I've been at the Amex for as long as I can remember, actually, and I just wanted to be warm as soon as the final whistle went.
So I was about to say, let me ask you, obviously I missed last week due to a family bereavement and couldn't attend. Sorry, bad fan, but you know, there are times when family has to come first. So you were there and I know that you and Andy have parked yourself next to the tunnel so that when the final whistle goes, you don't even bother your backsides applauding the team off. You're there for the first beer, front of the queue, like a naughty little schoolboy. But the point is, did you, at the final whistle, hear any boos yourself?
As I said, I was freezing. I legged it. I just wanted to be warm.
Did you feel it coming?
I had hats and hoods and scarves and everything, just trying to keep warm, to be honest. But
sure, but could you feel
I
it coming?
I didn't hear anything myself. I mean, listening back to the highlights today, I didn't hear anything on there. But obviously, it was a small minority that were doing it. I mean, I can understand the frustration. I mean, it was a game where it's a textbook Albion thing. I mean, we were having the same conversation week in, week out, and we'll carry on for a bit probably, but where we're dominant and not finishing teams off. Now, we did play in the game. I mean, to be fair, we did play very well, and we played some lovely football. We had the Lamptey's flair. We had Cucurella's hair. It was... absolutely, it was, you know, it was some sparkling midfield play, and it's just that thing which we've had time and time again, which we thought we'd got rid of at the beginning of the season, where we were winning some games and taking the chances, but it just didn't happen. So I can understand the frustration,
but you don't
boo your own team.
We're talking about a different level here, aren't we? To be honest, I think that probably when it comes to context that people don't think about it, but there's a couple of things that do raise their head here. And then Tom, actually, before I go into my treatise here on the telly, I don't know if where you're watching you had the sound off. Did it come across on the effects mics on the telly?
Yeah, it did actually. It took me back slightly because it came as a bit of a surprise. You could get a sense that the atmosphere was getting an element of frustration as the game went on longer, but still didn't expect the boos. And whilst it was clearly a minority, it was audible on the coverage. So it took me by surprise, to be honest, because as you say, you know, we'd actually played quite well. It's that final bit.
Quite. So for me, what I think here is the story itself isn't the boos themselves per se. It's that now we've finally come of age, not as a Premier League club, but Premier fans, and having that air of self-entitlement. Now, let's put this into some kind of context, because when people boo, they're not offering up any context. They're offering up a feeling in the here and now. And I'm sure that as you're having your pints afterwards, AD, you're probably sort of a bit frustrated with yet another really good performance that didn't yield the 3 points. That bit we get. But there's a couple of things here. One, we were playing Leeds, and I think this is actually Brighton fans and probably many other Premier League fans' view of Leeds United at the moment is that they are potential relegation fodder. So with all due respect, we should be beating hashtag teams like Leeds. You know, they got they were on a golden trajectory last season. And yeah, I think it was all a little bit Emperor's New Clothes, personally. And I'm actually not surprised that, you know, they're not going to be the team that tears up the division that we thought that, you know, well, that they thought they would be. But that's by the by. We know that Leeds are there for the taking. We have a very good record against them at the Amex as well. So there's that. Oh, my God, we couldn't beat Leeds. But then there is this context of, for those who actually disagree with the booing, is that, hey, hang on, we're in seventh. But even then, if we were in 17th, as you just said, AD, what good can be had from booing apart from someone offloading or showing up their innate ignorance of where this club's going, the direction of travel it's on, and let's face it, that direction of travel is still upwards for the most part. What can be obtained and gained by someone booing, Tom?
I agree. And I think there's two other levels to it. I think there's one, there's a view that if you're not winning, you're playing badly, and performances and results don't always match up, as we very well know over the last 18 months. And the second thing, I think, from the side of people against booing, which I think is the majority, there is quite a vocal side that tries to relate us now to the days at Gillingham, the days that the Goldstone was taken from under our feet. And I don't think that's necessarily the right way to go about it either. I think you have to look at the context of where we are at the moment in our journey. I think it's right to have that historical element, but that should not be a reason to have a go at other people.
Tom, are you alluding to Graham's comments about a history lesson?
Not necessarily. I think that was a bit of sarcasm from Potter and obviously frustration from his side. I just think that, you know, the fan base has changed an awful lot over the last 5 or 10 years, especially since the move to Falmer. And I think we need to be inclusive of everyone and understand some of the reasons. I think because we were at Gillingham 20 years ago, whatever, 25 years ago, and that's why we should just accept everything the club's doing now because we're in the Premier League. That's not a...
No, it's never as simple as that. And I think that's what probably upsets those who were there. You know, some people feel, and I think probably wrongly, that the work that they did 20, 25 years ago is being undone by people not appreciating the fact. But I think, in that sense, Tom, I fully agree with you. But I think the history lesson itself must also, if one must talk about a history lesson, like I say, you don't have to, but if you do, we're in our highest sustained position the club has ever been in since it was formed in 1901. Now, if you're going to look at it in that sense, you've got to then make the point and you that this is the best team that we've ever had. And yet, you know, we are still missing a striker. Now, it's everything, absolutely everything is relative. And this is where, for instance, I'm going to use Leeds United fans talking about Ben White and for them, if Ben White was brilliant at Leeds, therefore he's a brilliant, brilliant footballer. But all he had done at the time at Leeds was have a really good season in the Championship. Now, we had Bobby Zamora, we had Leon Knight, we had Glenn Murray, Peter Ward. None of whom have been overly prolific, apart from Glenn Murray, obviously, overly prolific as top division strikers. So whilst a player might have been brilliant for us, it doesn't necessarily follow. So if you put that in context and put Neil Maupay into a third division Brighton side, he's a 35 goal a season striker, and Wardy's records would look puny in comparison. So that for me is the level of context, is that everything is relative. And here we are now, elevated to seventh place. But for most people, and I see the point, for most people, if we're going to be in seventh place, then let's play and win like a seventh place team. Yeah, and we didn't against someone who we consider our inferior.
Yeah, but Al, I mean, you were talking about a history lesson there. I mean, let's roll back the years back to our ancient past, and our highest ever league finish in the top division was 13th, and that was under a manager that also got booed.
Well, quite for boring football, and he was on a journey himself to actually sort out the team in itself, which was. You know, a team that had been struggling, the parallels are there. But I think what we've got in this instance now, so we're talking, 39 years? No, 40 years later. It is actually the 40th anniversary of our highest ever finish. But your point you're making is that, one, we finished 13th, having dallied in fifth or sixth for a week or two. Since this season started, we haven't been outside, the top eight? And it's now December. We have never, ever, ever had that in our history. And even at the beginning of this season, if someone had said to you, right, come December, you know, when the madness starts in December, we will not have been outside the top eight.
Okay,
we're back to your Columbia marching powder that you were talking about, before we came on air, AD. That's not to say that is reason itself not to boo. I just think reason itself not to boo is just don't boo, because it has no positive effects on anyone. Sorry, Tom, I'm going to say.
I agree that it doesn't have any positive effect. But I also think that we might be underestimating how important some of these points might be the end of the season. I think going on a run of, is it 8 games now without a win? Yeah, we've only lost 9, sorry. Yeah. And we've only lost 2 games. And if you look at some of the teams that we've played in that run, you know, they're good teams. This is a tough league. And actually, we are progressing. And I think that probably, you know, creates some of this frustration that people have, is because our performances have been consistently high for 2 seasons, really. And you just can feel that you're not getting the rewards from it.
So my point would be, okay, we're playing brilliant football. And like I say, there's some of the football we've seen that we've just never have seen. We were amazed when Gus Poyet came along and we were playing football like we hadn't seen. This is, you know, this is 3 stages higher.
Yeah.
So, and your point being, I think the point that everyone's ever made for the past 18 months is that we can't stick the ball in the goal. And if it's going to boo, is it booing the team? Is it booing Graham? Is it booing the individual players? I mean, he actually said, look, you know, don't blame them, blame me. I'm actually not convinced that booing the team is actually necessary about the team. It is entirely about the individual doing it, because we are all frustrated. There were 30,000 people at that game, of which 27,000 left frustrated, because, you know, there were 3 points begging to be had. But not everyone expresses it by booing. But booing is in itself an expression. I put it up there actually with spitting, of blatant rudeness. I mean, spitting is a sign of contempt. Booing is effectively a sign of contempt. And for me, whilst you might be frustrated, it's got little to do with the team and everyone, everything to do with the person who's doing it.
Okay, well, let's move it on to there, and let's get down to the nuts and bolts of it. And the fireworks were absolutely brilliant before the game.
Yes, looked good.
It was. I just walked in there and saw these fireworks. I'm like, oh my god, it's amazing. What a burst of colour. What a clash of colours. Oh, hang on, let's talk about colour clashes. I was at the game, and I remember saying to Andy Bass, who's next to it at the games.
Yeah.
This is a major problem here, because I mean, there's been a big thing about it, particularly with colorblind people. And listening to Kieran Maguire's excellent Proof of Football podcast today, and he says, I don't even know what the color lilac is. And when you've got a team that's kit is predominantly blue, and a team who are wearing a kit that from a distance looks blue, it was. Impossible to make it out.
It was really difficult on the TV as well, to be honest. You know, like when you watch games, you have things in the corner of your eye to kind of work out where play's going. It just completely takes away that. I don't understand how that was allowed to happen.
It's crazy. I mean, it's just a simple thing out.
What is kit lilac?
That is the official term, I believe.
Right. And what colour to you did it look under the lights?
When you got a team that wear blue and white stripes, which combined look lilac from a distance, and with a solid blue back, it was a massive clash of colours.
Well, lilac is a kind of a pinky mauve colour.
No, I mean it was bad.
Are you saying it's basically there was a colour clash?
There was a colour clash, yeah.
But the thing is, I think there's when it comes to colorblind people, and I really can't talk for them, but from what certain people have told me, it's the color is one thing. It's not the color, and this is what Kieran talks about, it's the tone. So a solid red and a solid green shirt will look the same to them. But what we've got in this instance is Brighton wearing stripes and Leeds in plain shirts. So if color is an issue, it's not the fact it's lilac, it's the fact it's the tonal difference. So what we're talking about here is a striped team versus a pale team. It's if, for instance, they're wearing blue and white stripes and Brentford were wearing their home shirts, which once upon a time we used to have. But nowadays isn't allowed because probably for that very reason.
It is allowed.
Sorry?
It is allowed. I mean, we wore stripes at Southampton last year. Oh no, we didn't.
We never wear stripes at a striped club. We didn't wear it at Brentford.
No, we have done. We definitely.
It doesn't help though.
Yeah, only in days of way back in this. We haven't.
No,
done it for
I could remember a game last season. But,
Remind me.
There's been a few. Go on, Tom.
It doesn't help though when only half the shirt is striped. So when when the players have got their backs, it's a bit more difficult.
I mean, and it's small, you know, it's small margins, marginal gains. I mean, when you've got people employing throwing coaches and free kick coaches, I mean, a marginal gain would be being able to see your own player from a distance from 30 yards away and actually.
Yeah, but you're seeking to presume that the view that you've got is the view that they've got, and therefore
it was the same pitch side. I'm not alone in saying this. A lot of people have been wading in on this as well, and it is an issue. I mean, for instance,
well, hang on, it is for fans. Clearly, it is for fans, but the players are complaining about it.
Can we blame that on them not scoring then?
Yes, let's do that. But absolutely, they couldn't. They were passing to the opposition players. That's what was happening.
One seems to presume that if the players really, 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 really weren't happy about it, they would have actually said something. I personally don't believe, because what they're looking at, especially when they're looking down at the ball, and I've been told this, is that if you've got the same colour socks on, yes, you've got a problem, because what you're doing is you're looking down and you see your teammates have got, in our case, it's blue, in these cases, lilac or whatever pale blue you think lilac is. And then we also got different colour shorts on. Like I say, tonally, if you're a TV person or you're watching it, yes, it's going to be different. I get all this from the fact that, you know, when you're doing graphic design, you have to sort of like consider tones and hues and what have you when you're doing Photoshop and whatnot. But when you've got effectively two different shaped kits, i.e. one stripe, one's plain, then for the most part, I mean, Leeds possibly could have even been in a closer colour kit than they were in, and probably it would have still been okay. And I have seen that, and it worked. And let's face it, there's been rugby games where one team's in red and black hoops and one team's in red, black and white hoops, and they still tell each other apart. So it's not what we see, it's what the players see that's important.
Yeah, well...
And let's hark back to that famous Southampton Man U game. Southampton won 6-3. Man U players were moaning. Not that there was a colour clash, but they couldn't see each other from the background of the crowd. So they changed their shirts at halftime. So it's not about the colour per se, it's the tone.
It's not that difficult to have a kit that is completely different, a completely different colour. I mean, Plymouth are playing Rochdale this week, and they've actually come out and said, okay, blue and green are very different colours. I mean, you could possibly get away, you could wear your home kit, but they've made a point of saying, no, we're going to wear white, and you can wear blue, and that will be a difference. So. Isn't and they said that, and that is to help colourblind people.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. let's move on from that, Al. It was, in terms of the game, Tom, I mean, obviously we can talk about the missed chances. We know that there was an open goal missed. We know that these sort of things, sometimes it's easier to score than it is to miss. But let's talk about the positives. And one of those was the fact that Tarik Lamptey started the game. And he's really, really getting back up to speed, isn't he?
Yeah, in every sense of the word. You know, it's so great to just have him back on the pitch. But also, I think the benefit of having someone like Cucurella in the team is it potentially gives Lamptey that little bit more space because opposition now have to be wary of both flanks. But what I thought was quite interesting with Lamptey in particular was seemed to play a lot higher up and was almost playing in that kind of midfield and wing role that, you know, we're not necessarily used to seeing him in. So it just meant that when he got the ball, he was already halfway up the pitch. So I just think that directness that he gives us is something that we've been lacking, especially the back end of last season and this little patch that we've been going through. So it's just so great to kind of have him back on the pitch.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, we'll talk about West Ham in a bit, but it's we rested Lamptey because obviously with his injuries, we've got to give him the opportunity to recover, particularly with the amount of games that we've got coming up. But the interesting thing was that his direct replacement was Jeremy Sarmiento against West Ham, and that is a forward player.
Yeah, but then I think equally, if you look at the squad as a whole, I mean, we have a bit of a running joke that, you know, when a new player comes in, maybe he's going to play right wing back. Just the versatility that is expected of players under Graham Potter, you know, just because a lineup kind of suggests that someone's going to play in a particular position doesn't necessarily mean they will. But I think it does show that maybe Lamptey's attacking prowess is more valued.
Well, what I love is that when the club releases the an hour before kickoff, it releases the teams, the team and the substitutes. I love the fact that it puts Cucurella and Lamptey off in there as midfield players. And so when I think the BBC do their captions, they kind of look like wingers, but you've also got, I mean, you know, Cucurella is not a midfield. Well, he could well play in midfield, but he's not a midfield player. With that hair, he doesn't have all-round vision. Yeah, there is obviously the standing joke the Brighton fans have, but when they see the starting 11, you think, well, there's about four different formats you could come up with this for the players in question. But when you do have Lamptey and Cucurella playing together, it's not the be-all and end-all, because I still think that the midfield engine is key. We'll talk about the West Ham game in the second half of the show. Because we started, you're saying that Sarmiento was his replacement. Actually, it was a back four that we started with. I've got to say that there's been a slight regression. And I don't know if any of you have noticed it, because I've been a massive fan of his. But there's been a slight regression in the form of Joel Veltman. I don't know if that's anything you agree with or picked up on. But he's passing his I don't know what's happened. His confidence looks a bit shot to pieces. Have either of you two picked up on that at all?
Tom?
I'll take that as a no.
I think it's hard to consistently perform at a really, really high level, and I think he's been used slightly less and been moved around into different positions, so it's probably hard to get that consistency in performance. But I don't think it's been hugely noticeable. I think the same could be kind of leveled at a few players that have dropped in and out.
Maybe. I'm not picking on him.
You could look at all sorts of different positions out, and I was thinking that as much as I like Mark Cucurella, we've been more effective with Solly March in the side. But then you can't knock Cucurella's performances.
I prefer if Cucurella and March are going to be in the same side, I prefer March to be on the right hand side. I just do. Maybe because Cucurella and March are, you know, they're similar players and they get under each other's feet. But the whole notion of March being able to cut in, which for some reason does annoy people, this whole notion of a left-footed right winger or a right-footed left winger. I don't seem to recall anyone moaning about Paul Watson, by the way. So, yeah, exactly. So
That's because, yeah, Bobby Zamora's a right, Matt.
Well, there is that. Yeah, there is that. But no, I mean, it sounds like I'm picking on Veltman. I'm really not. But then there has been a dip in form. And again, we'll talk about...
Well, I am actually going to pick on someone here, because you mentioned midfield players And I've got a bit, I'm sorry, Tom, I've got a little bit of a bet noir at the moment about a certain player. And
is it Adam Lallana, the same one I've had for the past 2 months?
It might be the same person.
Yeah, what happens, he has a really good game against West Ham. So
I mean, there's been bits and pieces that he's been doing really well, but he comes with a reputation, then he scored a lot of important goals in his career, but he just seems to have forgotten how to do it. Tom.
Yeah, but then I think, you know, Lallana, he has missed some golden opportunities, but I think they must each have a bet that goes into the team's end of season fund as to who can miss the worst goal, have a good night out on it instead.
That pot is going to be massive.
Yeah, every game gets added to. But I think for me, Lallana is not in that team to be that out and out finisher. What he does in the build up, I think, makes up for it, and we ultimately still end up with the same result, which is it going wide or high. Yeah. I think he's an important player, and you can see when he leaves the pitch, you sometimes lose that kind of one touch and that
energy, don't you?
Phase through midfield.
Yeah,
he does move
the ball a lot quicker, and quite often a lot of the players aren't on the same wavelength. But
the interesting point you make there, Tom, is he's not an out and out finisher. He's not a centre forward. He's not this. He's not that. And as if professional footballers are defined by the position you know them to be. If he gets himself in a good position, he's got a good scoring chance or a good shooting chance. As a professional footballer, you know, it doesn't matter if you're known as a centre forward or known as a midfielder or known as a defender, and I probably would excuse Shane Duffy at this moment in time. If you can shoot, you know, if you're a professional footballer, you should know how to shoot and shoot accurately. It bothers me not that he's not a centre forward. He's there, he's in position, he should know how to finish.
I agree, and I actually think that that's one of the biggest areas, last season especially. And at the moment, midfield did not contribute enough goals. Okay. It wasn't necessarily about our forwards not scoring. It was the fact that they weren't backed up by other areas of the team.
Okay, well, we'll come to that bit in a minute. But first, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, an online gallery of over 120,000 football shirts.
Wowee, man!
I know. Phil's given us another shirt of the week here, which I'm going to which I'll tell you all about in a minute. But first, Tom, can you just describe this for me?
I actually really quite like this shirt. It's quite simple. It's relatively thin, black and bright yellow stripes on the front. It's long sleeve with yellow sleeves. A really nice understated.
Can you describe the badge?
The badge? Yeah, it's two birds they're quite cartoony, so I'm not going to try and say what birds they are, with a football in the middle.
It's kind of like a double-headed eagle, but in yellow and black. When you said two birds, yeah, we're talking about Baccarat, but one of them died a few months ago, so let's not go down that route. It's made by Macron. It is nice and neat and tidy. It's clearly one of Phil's shirts, because I recognize the louvered lines behind the mannequin he's got here. Now, there's one of two things here that spring to mind, although the badge might put me off. I'm either thinking, because it's yellow and black, it's going to be, I think it's Galatasaray that playing yellow and black, is it not? The other one is Peñarol of Montevideo. But above and beyond that, I wouldn't have a clue. Tom, do you have any idea who this might be?
Yeah, so on the left, the league badge, I think, has Divisie at the end. So I think it's a Dutch team.
You would be correct.
Yes, you are right.
So with yellow and black and Danish football, Vitesse?
Yes, it is.
Well played, Tom.
Well done, Tom. And for the eagle-eared around you, you may have noticed, well, Phil had a week off a few weeks ago. And I did the shirt of the week, and I also chose Vitesse. shirt. So this is Phil's description of this one. And this is a little bit more special, actually. And as you said, Al, you're quite correct. This is the latest addition to Phil's collection. And it is the 2014 to 2015 home shirt of Dutch Eredivisie side Vitesse, which is the correct name. And this is indeed a match shirt worn by the former Albion midfielder, Davy Purper. Vitesse were formed in 1892, and since 1996 have played the home games at the 21,248 capacity Gelre Dome in the city of Arnhem. They go by the catchy nickname of FC Hollywood upon Rhine and have distinct fan groups who occupy the various areas of the stadium to ensure great support for the team and a great atmosphere. The fans themselves chose Brohim by Pennywise to be used as goal music. Oh, God. And they play Status Quo, Whatever You Want in the stadium when the teams enter the stadium. Defender Theo Bos was born in 1965, and in 1983 he made his debut for Vitesse. As a one-team man, he made over 429 appearances for the side before retiring in 1998. He sadly passed away in 2013, and such was his influence on the club, a statue was erected in his honour, as well as a stand in the stadium being named after him. The number 4 short shirt is no longer worn by Vitesse sides, and to everyone in the city, he is simply known Mr. Vitesse. The obvious link to the album is, I guess, Davy Purper, who made 142 league appearances for Vitesse between 2008 and 2015. And in his time, he played 107 times for us. You can also have French defender Romaric Yappe if you like. He joined our development setup from PSG in 2019 and made one appearance for the Albion in the EFL Cup in 2019 before his move to Vitesse last summer. I should just also point out at this point that the Dutch contingent were over for the first time in 2 years. Our good friends Werner and Lido, so hello to them. They came to see me on Saturday morning.
More so than the Dutch contingent, actually Vitesse Arnhem fans.
They are Vitesse fans, indeed. And it was lovely to see them back in the stadium. Unfortunately, we could not send them back with any goals to celebrate.
No, and this, I have, like I say, mixed memories of Arnhem. Lovely city. I went there for Euro 2000. And for those who like to hear me moan, to give it context, because I know I've moaned about it on the Albion Roar before, I saw probably one of the worst games of football ever, of Norway against Slovenia in Euro 2000 in Arnhem. It's interesting you said it's only 21,000. I felt that place felt a lot bigger, big airy place. I also remember it's the whole pitch, it drops down and then slides out like a tray when they want to air it properly. But that game was an absolute mingo. Ruined also by Graham Poll, who just seemed to make up his own rules that day. So, yeah, kind of bittersweet memories of going to Vitesse's ground. It's a nice, good, clean shirt. I mean, it's how shirts should be. Never mind all the rest of the nonsense they have to stick on their arms and on their backs and up their noses and what have you. It's a nice, good, clean shirt. I like it.
And not too much of a colour clash with too many people, I'd imagine. Well,
actually, I was told, and I have to know this as a graphic designer, that actually the most effective colour contrast that you have is yellow writing on a black background. That is more, to the human eye, that is more effective than white writing on a black background. I think it's possibly that the contrast is too big between white and black, so yellow sort of softens it a bit. So yellow and black is actually the best colour contrast you can have, furthest apart, but actually still working.
It's all a bit waspish to me, and I hate wasps.
Yeah, but it's bees, and I like bees.
Bees are all right, yeah. I suppose.
But... what, no bees, no honey, no food, no us. Go figure.
Let's move on. On Wednesday night, we made the short journey up to the London Stadium, or the Olympic Stadium, depending on what you want to call it. It's like West Ham like to have a stadium with two names, really, isn't it?
I don't think it is the Olympic Stadium anymore. That's the point. I think it is actually just the London Stadium.
Well, you know, the bowling ground probably didn't, was it? Upton Park, you know.
Again, it's just one of those things of misnaming it. Upton Park was the area of London, you know, and it should have been the bowling ground. So, yeah. I mean, you know me, I'm fussy with this sort of nonsense.
Who knew you'd be
who
fussy?
Who knew I could be so fussy?
One thing that Graham Potter wasn't fussy about was once again delving into the academy to give a young player a first start. And that was Jeremy Sarmiento, who did come on against Leeds and did very well. And I was absolutely delighted to see him given an opportunity, Tom.
Yeah, I think it's great now actually seeing some of kind of the pathway from the academy into the first team really, really coming to the fore. Went to an under-23s game a couple of weeks ago against Man City, and there's so much talent in that squad that is going to make it through. And I think with Sarmiento, he's had an opportunity, he's grabbed it two hands, and he looked absolutely devastated when he had to be taken off. And I think most people watching him were gutted for him as well.
Yeah. His debut lasted 13 minutes.
Well, to be fair, he's also now a full international as well, isn't he? So there's something about the quality of international football in South America versus our academy system, in as much as he can play for both at the same time. But yes, I mean, I've seen him play. I saw him play. He came on in the League Cup, and I kind of knew, had been watched, because I do tend to watch the under-23s when they're on the TV, on the computer at Lancing. And you get to see who's who. And at the moment, obviously, Evan Ferguson and Tolage are getting the headlines because of their goals. But Sarmiento's running play. So when he came on against Leicester, it wasn't a surprise. I mean, I think there was a lot of people, there was a surprise. I knew what was coming, and the fella didn't disappoint.
Well, he came on against Swansea as well at the Amex.
I think he did, yeah. I forgot which League Cup game it was, but certainly there was that. So, but there is obviously a massive leap up between that and playing in the Premier League and playing in what is now currently a top six side away from home. So, you know, I'm sure he would have settled into the game. But yes, that injury is an absolute bummer for him. And yeah, you can see what it meant to him. But, you know, I'm sure he'll be back soon enough. And, well, let's face it, when you've got this number of games that we've got coming up in 1 month, well done, the Premier League, for all your fixture handling there. Well done indeed. You know, you've got all the UEFA and Champions League for everyone else. And then, oh, hang on, we've got about 8 games left over. I know, let's concertina them into December. Well done, you chumps. And let's make one on Boxing Day at 8 o'clock.
Well, I did say on the show, look, I think it was last week, I said that it took us nearly 4 months to play the first 11 games of the season, and now we've got 11 games in 42 days.
I thought I was going to say next 11 games tomorrow, so yeah.
Yeah, one after the other.
Sorry, just quickly, talking to the under-23s, well done again today, lads. Beat Liverpool 3-0, so...
Yeah, 2 goals from Laurent Tolage as well. Yep. Another prospect, hopefully... that will send the warning sign across our strikers who are not scoring goals. And once again, I mean, after missing an open goal and another equally good chance against Leeds, Neil Maupay missed another very good chance. And then a minute later, the ball was in our net, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, you can't make it up, really. It's just the most Albion thing ever to do it like that. But again, it just comes back to concentration at set pieces when defending. Again, it's one of those things that I thought we'd got out of our game predominantly. Yeah, it came back then.
Well, previously...
The thing that got me, Tom, though, was, I mean, their goal, it was an identical goal to what they've been... It's almost like their trademark near post corner routine. And it's like, I mean, I know it was the first corner of the game. It's 4 minutes into it. But it's almost as if we didn't expect it. And we put the smallest person on the pitch, which is Sarmiento, at the near post.
The other thing to add to that is Sanchez just was nowhere. He thought about coming for it, then fought back, and it was almost Peter Brezovan-esque, just throwing his hands forward at West Ham. You know, it's one of those where it was just comical all round, really.
Yeah. Well, Rob, it was a game of two halves for him, wasn't it?
He didn't help himself by the way it looked. But, I mean, I thought, well, come on, Rob Green, who himself was not averse to a drop, see, like on the World Cup stage. But You know, come on, Rob Green, sort of, you know, goalkeepers union, talk us out of this. And even then, I think it was being diplomatic. He could see what Sanchez was trying to do, in as much as the defenders hadn't dealt with the near post stuff. And is that? And I think that the who, what's the name of the fellow? It was Suchek who got the final glancing touch. I think he was just too far in advance of the first post, the near post, for Sanchez to be there. It should have been. It just looked so bad because, you know, Sanchez himself ends up in the back of the net, and the ball's in the back of the net on the other side of the goal, and it looks ludicrous. But I think that what he was trying to do is second guess where the ball was going to go on the back of the fact that he knew that defenders were not going to be able to cover it.
Yeah, I mean, it was
that's just kind of what Rob Green was alluding to, but it just looked worse. I think it looked worse than it was. It looked awful, but
it was frustrating. I mean, and as was Morpay. I mean, to be fair to Morpay, it was a tougher chance than the ones he missed against Leeds, but it's still a very good chance. And for a striker at this level, you would expect, if you've got a sight of goal, to at least hit the target. And
mate, listen, having said that, I think that we tend to forget this, is that we've seen strikers playing against us over the last two seasons miss. It's just that we see Morpay doing it more often because we see him playing more often. But when we have opposition players coming down and they miss some absolute stinkers as well, it just seems to be that England or English football at the moment has a paucity, has a scarcity of finishers. There are a few, and those are the ones who are sending their team to the top of the table. Apart from that, there's far too many teams don't have those six-yard sniffers, Tom.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing. You know, you can't compare 90% of the strikers to the Salahs of this world. Yet, you know, everyone says, oh, we need a 20-goal striker. They don't exist in the Premier League outside of those top two or three. You go back the last few seasons, and I think there's only about five players in the last 4 years that have scored more than 20 goals. I mean, it just doesn't necessarily exist there.
Yeah, I mean, even Salah misses easy chances.
Well, yeah, we could spend silly money on a striker that we've never heard of, and if it doesn't come off, it doesn't come off. By the same token, we could have someone in our academy at the moment who is actually raring to go and is ready. We don't know until you put them there, and that is where you then have no choice but to trust Graham Potter with that decision.
I mean, I've made this point before. I mean, you look at West Ham; they spent 40 million on Allaire. You look at Newcastle; they spent over 40 million quid on Joelinton, and you know they haven't exactly hit the ground running. Like they're not putting up any trees. So you know,
well, we don't care if they hit.
That's why strikers get paid the most. They're goals. A really good one is worth their weight in gold. And you know what? I mean, Morpay does give more to the team than goals, Tom.
For sure. I mean, how many times does he pop up on the wing or in midfield and kind of play that link-up role? I think he does a lot more, but people will simply look at that goal score column.
Well, I think if you're going to have an idea as to Morpay's contribution to the team, look at the chance he fed for Jakob Moda, which Fabianski saved. That's that assist, as it would have been if it had gone in, was absolutely sublime. He turned it round the corner in a forest of West Ham players to give him a free and open chance, a very, very similar chance, incidentally, to which West Ham had later in the game. And they were bemoaning that they didn't score it. But no one's actually, but by the same token, they're also saying, well, it was a good save from Fabianski. Well, it was a good save from Sanchez. They were, you know, the shots themselves were very similar. But I would say that setup from Morpay was absolutely delicious.
I've got other issues about that move. But I mean, in terms of the finish and the save, it was very Gordon Smith against Gary Bailey, wasn't it?
He was quite close.
If Solly had played that ball through to Morpay properly like he'd intended to, then Morpay would have been clean through it. He wouldn't have had to pass it to Moda. But let's talk about Jakob Moda. He's had a run of games in the side in his favourite position alongside Yves Bissouma. He's getting forward. He's getting himself into a good position. He should have at least had one goal out of these two games, shouldn't he, Tom?
For sure. I mean, that for me, that chance that you just mentioned was more clear-cut than the Morpay one that everyone wants to talk about. But yeah, I like him. He's big. He's powerful. He likes running at players, and he's got some pace. I mean, there's a couple of times where he just skips past an opposition defender, so he's getting in the right positions. But just like a lot of our team, he's young and he's not the finished product. You know, there's got to be better things to come, not only for him but for a lot of that squad.
I totally agree with Tom there with that analysis, but I would add the caveat that I don't think he's particularly strong in the tackle. And when he's a one-on-one or needs some upper body strength, I think that needs to improve a little bit. He needs to fight that little bit harder. But when he's got the ball, for the most part, not every time, but for the most part, I think Graham Potter made some kind of allusion to him that he gave him some kind of, an opinion as to what he wanted out of the game, what he wanted out of his game. So somewhere down the line, I think that Potter wants more improvement from Murder, that he feels is there but isn't necessarily offering. We can't necessarily see what it is because we don't 100% always know what it is that Potter wants from Murder. We see, like you say, we see the forward runs, we see the pass, we see this, we see that. But, you know, there's other aspects of the game. When the ball's over there, what's Murder doing? Is he tracking his man? Is he doing this? Is he doing that? And these are the things we don't necessarily get to see, but Graham Potter has no choice but to see. And I'm just wondering that, you know, he gave him a little bit of an appraisal that said, look, you know, I want a little bit more out of you. So, but to be in that position, to even have that shot. I take your point about the Gordon Smith, Gary Bailey thing. Yeah, he was a little bit close that it was going to be difficult to dink it over him. He just took the shot at the goal and Fabianski just did very well. But I still say that irrespective of the Solly March pass that you got the hump with AD, Mopé's pass to Murder, I thought was superb.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about the mess that was the beginning of the second half, which had us all scratching our heads and probably giggling slightly. Which was that? Well, it was carbon copy of the first half, wasn't it? We missed a good half a chance at one end, and they went up to the other end and scored from a corner. I think most of us were probably saying it was a goal. Tom?
So, yeah, it was quite interesting, again, watching with the kind of view of VAR as it was happening as well on the TV, because no one seemed to really know what it was. And they checked so many things. At one point, they were checking a foul and then it was offside. But I think the bit that it was, he's clearly offside because there's only one player behind the goalkeeper. Yeah. So he's clearly offside. So it's one of those slightly obscure football rules. It doesn't come up very often, but was spot on.
But what worries me, Tom, is that how many commentators it is that forget that rule. Of all people that forget it, it's the commentators that forget it. It's two players that have to be close to the goal line, not one. One of which is usually the goalkeeper, but not always. So who was it on the line? Can you remind me? Was it Duffy on the line?
It was Duffy who the ball came off. So if the goal had stood, it would have been a Duffy own goal.
Yeah, but the point is that it doesn't matter where Duffy was. That's by the by. It's the fact that the ball came off. I think it was Antonio trickled forward.
Yeah,
and Antonio claimed it, which was probably one of the reasons why actually get the decision. Because if he hadn't claimed it,
VAR certainly, yeah.
Then they might have come to a different solution. I mean, it wasn't a clear and obvious error, basically.
Well, it was. It was clearly offside. It was clearly offside. I mean, there's no argument about that. The other two things they did check, which were foul on Alana and foul on Sanchez. No, VAR went straight past them because I fully agree. Lallana was spent his time looking at the defender, so he was looking to be clattered. He had no interest in the ball. And Sanchez, I think, ran into one of our own players. So those two, I think, not only was there not a clear and obvious error, I don't think either of them were a foul. But what was... And it's not clear and obvious, is, you know, because they have to do it by fact, is that yes, the last West Ham player to touch it was offside.
Still probably wasn't as funny as the first Arsenal goal last night, though, eh?
No.
You might have to see that. I haven't seen it yet. But I was at the Sussex Business Awards.
If you haven't seen it, just check it out. I mean, Man United were up in arms about the whole thing, but I mean, basically, De Gea probably didn't cover himself in too much glory.
Listen, we're down to the last 2 minutes of this week's show, so let's spend these last 2 minutes waxing glory over. Let's face it, everyone loves an overhead goal, don't they, Tom?
And you're wrong, Al. It was not... you're wrong. I love the goal. It was a very important goal. Ali J's was a better goal.
He's just trickled into the net.
No. I'm not sure Jahan Bash did anything other than shin it in the right direction.
Yeah.
I think the closeness of the defenders and how close Morpay was to goal, that is technically a much harder finish, I think. Yeah. Like, unbelievable finish.
I mean, was it as good as CMS's overhead kick against Burnley?
It's more spectacular.
Well, I don't know. CMS had no one around him. It's just the angle of the leg is just wrong. You know, he's just kind of just like flicked it over his shoulder, which is an overhead kick. But I want them to be like a level with the ground with their foot. I expect more acrobatics. I expect gold medal performances from an Olympic gymnast.
If he did do that, it wouldn't have gone in.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I was dancing like a loon when that went in, but
I just think that with Morpay, we just have to give him opportunities that no one expects him to score, because he seems to put those away and score world class goals, yet won't score a tap in from 6 yards.
And his goals do tend to come in streaks as well. He'll go on a hot streak and he'll score 4 in a row, and then he'll not score for another 10.
Well, that bodes well for us being at St Mary's, then, doesn't it? Or if he lasts it for the rest. Hey, if he has a hot streak for a month, hey, we've got 68 games this month. I'm up for that.
if these last 9 games is our rough patch of the season, what a rough patch it's been.
Absolutely.
Well, it would be symmetry to last season where we did that as well. But that is all we've actually got time for this week. And obviously, we were absolutely delighted for Neil. He did need that goal. And long may his spectacular goal routines continue. But that is it for this week. We've got a special show for you next week, hopefully. We'll talk more. Watch out for socials in regards to that. But for now, thanks to Tom Hyland. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been Eddie Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week. Bye.
I lost myself on a cool, damp night. I gave myself in that misty light. Was hypnotized by a strange delight under a lilac tree. I made wine from the lilac tree. Put my heart in its recipe. Makes me see what I want to see. And be what I want to be. When I think more than I want to think, I do things I never should do. I drink much more than I ought to drink, because it brings me back you. Lilac wine is sweet and heady, like my love. Lilac wine. Thank you. not see clearly? Isn't that she coming to me nearly here? Lilac wine is sweet and heady. Where's my love? Lilac wine. Isn't that she? Or am I just going crazy, dear? Lilac wine, I feel I'm ready.